CJSF is looking for new volunteers to come in and make radio. No experience is necessary. You can learn to DJ, edit sound, produce news, make posters, and host your own show. Come out to a weekly station orientation to get involved. Orientation times can be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm Michael Robert Kaditz. I'm with Brandon Brownlee. We are going to be doing part three of my series on biological and cultural evolution, the relationship between the two. So just a quick review of a principle that I think is important when we talk about evolution, which is whether change happens, and this applies to both biology and culture, or maybe biology and culture are the same. Where I'm going, really, does change happen in a way that I'm calling, borrowing from medieval concepts, does it happen per se? Are causal chains per se, meaning that the original cause must remain in existence for the entire causal chain to continue? Or are causal chains per accidens, which means that once the causal chain is set in motion, then the original cause, the first cause, can disappear, but the causal chain continues. So as far as I know, I'm the first one, and of course my research wasn't exhaustive, but as far as I know, I'm the first one that applied these concepts, which were actually related to proof for God in medieval times. As far as I know, I'm the only one that's applying these concepts to an analysis of evolution. I'm probably not the only one, but the only one that I know in my limited research so far. The idea of per se causal chain, that the first cause must remain in existence for the entire causal chain to continue, was one of the medieval proofs for God, that if God, as the first cause, stopped his intentional behavior which kept the universe in existence, then the universe would go out of existence. So the fact that anything exists, that the universe continues to exist, was proof, according to the medievals, was proof that God was still taking action. God was still directing things with his intentionality. Because if God, the first cause, the one moving the stick, which then moves the rock, which then moves the dirt, which then moves the feather or whatever it might be, all that would all stop if God wasn't continuing his, of course, his actions. His, according to medieval thinking, not my idea. But the per accidens causal chain can continue even if the first cause disappears. So an example of that might be generation to generation. So a child is born, that child has children, those children have children. The father, the grandfather, the great-grandfather don't have to continue to live in order for the children to live. So that would be a per accidens causal chain. So the reason I think this applies to an analysis of evolution is that when we see change over time, is that change happening such that it's cumulative and there's an aggregation of change such that the original cause, the first cause, the beginning of the whatever that cultural trend is or the biological trend, doesn't have to be there anymore? It's already done. It's a done deal. The culture's already changed, or the organisms have already changed. Or do we have a situation where we have a per se type causal chain where there is a constant attention required in order for the chain to continue, whether the first cause needs to either continue or be reinstituted to happen again for the change to be realized. So with biological evolution, which I think is the simpler case of the two, now that we know so much about genetics and from Darwin, well, we don't know genetics from Darwin, but we know about natural selection. In a sense, it's a simpler case because clearly, unless we deny genetics, unless we deny natural selection, which some people do, but most people, I think, don't anymore, at least most enlightened, educated people recognize that natural selection happens. I might get some flack for that statement. There's my bias, my scientific bias. I know there's still in many parts of the world, even in our part of the world, people who are religious and believe in design and creation and all that. So I do want to acknowledge that I think they're wrong, but I acknowledge that that viewpoint exists. So with biological evolution, quite clearly, the causal chains that we see from generation to generation are per accident's causal chain. The first cause doesn't need to be there anymore. It's already happened. The change has already happened. We're now moving along the causal chain. Humans already have two hands. They already have fingers. They already have the size brains, more or less, that all humans have. They already have their innate traits, innate biological traits. Whatever began that evolutionary movement, change, trend, whatever you want to call it, causal chain, it may be long gone. But even if it were, the hands, the fingers, the brain, the biological traits of a human are already intact. Now, that doesn't mean that because of new causes or stimuli appearing that we couldn't have further evolutionary change, maybe even a reversal. It's logically possible, but it happens over a long period of time. So as far as our generation, the next generation, the next generation, we inherit, without re-exposure to the original causes, the first cause, we inherit innately those traits. So that would be a per accidents type of causal chain. The complication comes when we talk about culture. Cultural evolution is a term which is somewhat ambiguous because when we use the term evolution to apply to culture, are we suggesting that same type of per accidents causal chain is happening with culture, the same thing that happens with genetics in the biological world? So if we look at a cultural trend, like let's say over a number of generations, there's been an increasing acceptance in Western culture of marijuana. So whereas even a few generations ago, when I was a little kid, Bad. You could go to jail for a long time for getting caught with pot. And now in much of the Western world, not everywhere, but much of the Western world, first there was a legalization of medical marijuana. Now there's legalization of recreational marijuana in many places, including Canada, at least up to certain quantities for personal recreational use. Seems like there's been a cultural change over the last, let's say, 100 years. Maybe less than 100 years. Is that a per accidents change? Do the forces that were in place that began to cause the liberalization of attitudes around marijuana, is it required that they're still in place? Another way of looking at that is, so I'm still posing the question, right? Because it's not so clear here with cultural evolution. If I, as a parent, support the legalization of marijuana, I think it's fine that recreational use of marijuana for your personal use is should be either decriminalized or legal. I don't see it as immoral or so horrible that it should be outlawed. Now I have children. I give birth to a couple offspring. Are they born with acceptance of legalization of marijuana? So when they start to understand, you know, when they're old enough to understand what marijuana is and what legal or illegal are, do they innately possess the liberal attitudes around marijuana that their parents did, that I did as a parent? Now, if we were talking about genetic evolution, quite clearly, my offspring are going to have physical characteristics of today's human beings without having to learn those characteristics or be taught those characteristics or internalize those characteristics or take some action or for society to take some action for the offspring to have those physical characteristics. That's what I was saying, that genetic evolution is quite clearly per accidents. The changes are innate. No effort is required. It'd be pretty hard not to have the, you'd have to, you know, do something pretty body altering to
beyond our current capacity.
It may might happen. We're talking about transhumanism, right? We can figure that in here. So transhumanism is a discipline, a movement, which the idea being that we can improve upon people, which I suppose could involve maybe even reversing some evolutionary phenomena that have happened.
Possibly, yeah.
Adding another hand, adding another. I really could use another arm and another hand. Brandon, do you ever have this situation? You don't have enough hands to do what you're trying to do. You drop stuff, right? You're trying to build something or carry things. This happens to me all the time. I'm always frustrated that I don't have another, at least one or two more hands.
No, that would be pretty useful. That would be very useful.
Yeah, but the process of biological evolution, genetic evolution, natural selection has given me the two hands that I have. I didn't have to do anything. My parents didn't have to do anything. No. So really, this is not a settled question when it comes to cultural evolution. It's interesting how, as in so many areas of philosophy, you get on one topic and you wind up crossing into another topic. So
yeah, well, philosophy is pretty general, so
yeah, and it's really cross-disciplinary.
Yeah, it absolutely
is. Whether it's philosophy of education, philosophy of science, philosophy of law, philosophy of art, philosophy of music, philosophy of mind, philosophy
it's quite everything. Intellectually low level in a way, not to like put it in a hierarchy, but if you think of it like a garden or something, you can almost think of philosophy as, you know, philosophers praising philosophy here. Philosophy is the kind of soil out of which things grow.
By low level, I assume you're not speaking of quality, but rather just hierarchical level. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's philosophy of everything else. So philosophers study about like how others do their work, like how scientists do their work, how lawyers do their work, how the healthcare professionals do their work, but not just how they do their work, but also the issues that speak to ethical issues, for example, in all those many disciplines.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of boilerplate answer that I usually give to people when they ask seriously, what is philosophy? I mean, that's a question that philosophers love to entertain themselves with, but if people really want an answer, you can say something like, philosophy is the study of fundamental concepts. You know, a biologist studies life, but they don't inquire into what is life. That would be a philosophical inquiry. That is a fundamental concept that must be presupposed for the study of biology, and that is for the philosophy of biology.
Right, and philosophers also study the way biologists do their study of biology.
Yeah.
And I know we're getting a little bit off onto a tangent here, but I'm going to bring it back because it does relate to what I'm talking about evolution. But great example of that is the current popularity of STS, science and technology studies, or science, technology and society. So STS is exploring the built-in cultural bias, for example, in the work of science and the scientific investigation, scientific research.
Interesting.
There's many examples of where science is not so, how would you say, like objective. The researchers, the scientists, bring their own cultural and personal biases into their laboratory. And so the question is, and I think many STS theorists would argue that there's no such thing as objective, unbiased science. That doesn't mean that you don't strive for some sort of objectivity, but you have to understand that you have to be critical, right? You have to scrutinize and be skeptical of scientific claims to the extent that they might be culturally biased, or, you know, which might introduce all kinds of logical fallacies into your scientific claims.
Yeah.
Like confirmation bias, for example. Well, one example is, of course, the way that Western science treats indigenous culture. So often Western scientists will be critical of indigenous claims as non-scientific, pseudoscientific, and they may be, but if a Western scientist studies indigenous culture or any culture from the outside, then that Western scientist may not be really understanding or getting the full extent of what's being, you know, what the theories are within that culture.
Yeah, just an off-the-bat assumption would not be very scientific, though.
Right. But anyway, the reason I brought this whole thing up is because as soon as I start talking about, are humans born with cultural values or are they acquired, which now speaks to my analogy of, are the causal chains which brought about those cultural values, are they transmitted per se or per accidents? Now we get into all kinds of other fields, right? We get into language acquisition.
Yeah.
We get into, you know, anthropology, get into psychology. Definitely language acquisition. That's one of the important debates in language acquisition. Does language prompt thinking? So let's say you have a newborn human infant. Does that infant have thoughts and have cognition already innately, and then eventually learns the language to express those thoughts? If that were the case, it would seem that culture, or at least cognition, is innate. It's transmitted sort of analogous to, you know, genetics, or maybe it is genetics. Maybe culture is transmitted genetically, or at least some aspects of culture, at least a partial understanding of culture. It doesn't have to be all one way or the other way, right?
And yeah, insofar as it's cognitive in that sense, yeah.
Right. So if because the current state of Western culture is that there is a acceptance of marijuana, or at least more of an acceptance than there used to be, does that mean that my children will also have that acceptance without or before they've been influenced by me or by school? So it ties into, you know, language acquisition. So on the other hand, if humans are born tabula rasa, clean slate. And there are cultural values, cultural information, beliefs are only acquired from their environment. That might be their family environment, from school, from peers, from other from television, whatever other information is bombarding them, right? They're bombarding their sense organs. So they're born clean, and then all that cultural stuff is learned. Then we have a per se type of transmission where the stimulus is required or re-stimulation is required. Mm-hmm. Human culture would not continue without it constantly being taught. There needs to be that first cause again.
Yeah.
So I don't know for sure. I don't know, but I'm asking the question, you know, I'm being true to philosophy here. I'm asking the question, and I know where there's going to be, there's many theories of language acquisition. There's over the decades and centuries, there's been many theories around, are humans born tabula rasa, or are they born already predisposed to believing certain ways, or do they in fact already believe certain ways?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. Yeah. Were you going to say something? Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, no. I mean, I try, like, every time you get these kinds of problems where you have one possibility and another possibility, and both seem really plausible because they seem to capture some aspect of reality. So, for example, if language is innate, then how do you explain how people learn different languages, specifically languages that they're, or languages into the place that they're born into? So, because there seems to be something contingent there. But at the same time, there does seem to be something innate about language. I don't want to say per se, because I don't want to confuse the audience. But there seems to be something natural about using language itself. So I'm trying to square these two really intuitive ideas that we're born with innate psychological structures, like we might be naturally linguistic creatures, but also trying to explain, okay, well, people are also born into different languages, they're born into different dialects within those languages. So trying to find the nuance in the middle of those is where you start getting really interesting theories about, questions like language acquisition. I'm thinking also of, you know, in our philosophy world, we have the interesting compatibilist answer to the problem of determinism versus free will. You know, it's really implausible that it's like one or the other, and the compatibilists are usually the ones trying to explain, how do these two things mix? How do we, you know, there seems to be this really obvious thing about reality causes determine effects, and yet we have this experience of free will that we still have to explain. So how do we square that circle? And that's where you get a lot of theorizing. I'm not going to opine on any of that, but that's just another field where trying to give an interesting answer seems to want to capture both of these, you know? I've done a little bit of reading into Vygotsky, and I think Aaron actually mentioned Vygotsky last show. I wish I had read Vygotsky enough to speak with a certain amount of authority, and I also wish Aaron were here to correct me if I were going wrong, but I feel like Vygotsky gives an interesting answer to this question of how language acquisition works, and as an explanation of cognition, and in that way culture, if we're going to equate cognition and culture. But it's essentially that, so the inherent part is this: we are inherently linguistic, but we are also inherently cognitive, which is to say that we have higher mental processes. But those develop over time. So you don't have higher mental processes right from the get-go. Your brain kind of has to develop. And that explains the emergence of things like, or it explains the apparent gap of like infants don't seem to have thoughts. They kind of think out in the world. So an infant is born, they listen to and acquire language over time, and they start speaking. And eventually, as their brain develops, they acquire reflexivity in their language use. They can start directing their language, not just at others, but at themselves. And they get better and better and better at that until they don't have to use language to understand what they mean. And that's just what thinking is. I'm kind of biased to really like this because this explains Plato in the Theaetetus when he says that thinking is the soul in dialogue with itself. So I'm a little bit biased because it confirms Plato. But I also just like really like that idea of thinking as having a conversation with yourself. But here is a developmental psychological account of how you would get to that. And it meshes both of these. You have an innate linguistic capacity that develops into a cognitive capacity, but the contingencies are explained by the environment that you're born into. So the language and the thoughts that you have and the culture, which you acquire from other speakers. You think with other people first before you think to yourself. You get practice doing cognition by having conversations with people. And then as your brain develops, you can direct those conversations at yourself. And there's all sorts of other self-reflexive, activities. So imagining things is just seeing to yourself, or the experience of willing is deciding with people to yourself. It's an interesting theory, and I hope I'm capturing it right, but that's why I have an interest in it. It seems to be this.
So you made an important point that I just wanted to underscore, which is that there are positions in between the two extremes. So one extreme being language is acquired before cognition, which would mean that there's no cognition until culture is internalized. So that would entail the idea that culture is learned.
Mm-hmm.
Cognition is learned. Cultural ideas, values, beliefs, they're learned because before they're learned, before they're internalized from the culture, there's clean slate, tabula rasa. On the other hand, on the other extreme, you have a claim that infants are born with certain beliefs and ideas, or at least predisposed to thinking in certain ways. That is to say that many of the beliefs that we have in our culture, our cultures, are innate. They're not constructed, but rather they're innate. Humans are just born with them. Eventually, infants will discover the words. They'll pull words out of the world of language to describe what they're already thinking, the cognition that already exists. Two opposite views, but there are views, you know, between those two extremes. And one example I know would be Chomsky. Chomsky argues that there's a scaffolding for language that humans are born with, that there are various common ways that all languages are structured. And, you know, if you take philosophy of language, you'll get more into detail on that. You know, philosophy of language courses will drill down on exactly what those claims are. Mm-hmm. But the important point to know is that Chomsky, for example, and others land somewhere in between those two extremes, such that there's a certain predisposition to certain structures of language, certain ways of thinking, structures of thinking, and that then it gets filled in or built upon by the particular culture, so that one's beliefs and views and ways of looking at the world would be a combination of innate features and also culturally relative features. I wanted to talk about how one contemporary cultural evolution theorist who's very well known and respected by the name of Joe Heinrich